Let's squirt one die in the back.
I was just saying that I don't need to see you, I just need to hear you.
Okay.
We'll continue our exploration of the mandala. Yesterday, Dharmadipa helped us to explore ethics and came out with a very interesting point, particularly very thoughtful reflections on ethics in terms of the mind. And in a way, we're going to go, in a sense, even further into the mind. So, as we start looking at meditation. So, I'm looking forward to what Dharmadipa has got to say on meditation.
Yes, so I'm going to sort of talk around meditation a bit. I'm not sure if it's well structured what I'm going to do. Got some structure. But I want to look at meditation with the help of different teachings or lists, which we may or may not be familiar with. Yeah, so meditation is the second part of the threefold path. It's sort of the fifth of the six paramitas. So it's obviously got a very central position in Buddhism. And again, I think it's to do with the importance of mind in Buddhism. Yeah. The sort of the absolute centrality of mind and mental activity in Buddhism. I mentioned the Dhammapada yesterday, the first two verses, experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and so on. So we have the centrality of mind, the importance of mental activity as the root for every, not only for all physical and verbal activity, but mental activity also as the root which conditions how we see the world. Yeah. I think that's in a sense what the teaching of karma is about, is through our habitual mental activity, we get into a habit of seeing the world in a particular way, and this is the world we inherit, we live in. It's the world we see. So again, to state something obvious, meditation is an action. It's action with the mind in a particular formal or in a particular almost ideal context. Because in meditation, we directly work on our mind or we directly train our mind. I think it's probably best to see meditation as a sort of training. Probably the best way to describe meditation is actually sport. I always used to do that when I had this sort of, in the Essence Center, beginners, especially school classes, because I thought meditation is about lying on your back and relaxing. I said, no, it's about sport, which some people found much more helpful. And again, sort of something obvious. Our action, our mental action, karmic action, can be skillful or unskillful. In other words, meditation can be good or bad. Yeah, we can do it better or not so good. So there are actually bad meditations. I know it's a nice saying, there are no bad meditations, but I don't believe it. Because, I mean, if you do something well, you can do it not so well. So I'm afraid there are bad meditations. I think a bad meditation is when you just sort of sit there, get impatient about the bell ringer, sort of doze around, think about this, that, and the other, and hope for it to be over. That's a wasted meditation, basically. So we have to, I think one of the things we have to start looking at with meditation is sort of looking at the way we look at meditation and even talk about it. And it can easily happen that we have a very passive attitude to meditation, as if it's something that happens to us. Yeah. So even the language we use, I had a good meditation, I had a bad meditation. I was in the hindrances. It's almost as if our language has a sort of worldview, this is sort of meditation deity or God, which dishes out good or bad meditations according to his mood. So it's not that I was distracted, I distracted myself. Yeah, that's actually a more accurate way to talk about it. So maybe just to begin with, we need to even talk about what we do in meditation in more active terms, rather than something. Meditation is not something we're the victim of. Yeah, we're not the victim of meditation, it's actually an activity we do. So it's about taking responsibility and be honest. And this gets expressed in the teaching of right effort or perfect effort in the Noble Eightfold Path. And if you remember the lecture series by Bhante on the Eightfold Path, Vision and Transformation. And the, I think the sixth one, the sixth stage of the Eightfold Path is right or perfect effort. And that's basically meditation. Yeah, the way perfect effort is being talked about by Bhante in the lecture and also in the Pali Canon, where Bhante got it from, is in terms of effort and meditation. And the standard list, the standard framework to do this, is the four right efforts. So I want to talk a bit, I want to use the four right efforts as a way in. The four right efforts are preventing unarisen unskillful states, eradicating arisen unskillful states, developing unarisen skillful states, and maintaining arisen skillful states. That sounds a bit complicated. Basically, we have to recognize the skillful states and unskillful states. Unskillful states, we want to prevent from arising. If they have arisen, we want to do something about them. Skillful states, if they haven't arisen, do something about them. If they have arisen, maintain them or nurture them or deepen them. I think one way of looking at the teaching of the four efforts is sort of there's no state which is so bad that you can't meditate. And there's no state which is so good that you don't have to make any more effort. Yeah. I think it's a way of looking at that. Yeah. So to do this, I think Bhante talks about this in the lecture, before we can apply any of the efforts, we have to know where we stand. We have to know what's going on in our mind at the moment. When we meditate. So we need to know what skillful and unskillful states are, and we need to know which state we are in. Just a different way of, slightly different way of looking at all this in terms of the mandala. We could say that meditation is reorganization of the mandala of one's own mind. Yeah, so our own mind is the mandala, with hopefully the Buddha at the center of it. And with the Buddha at the center of our mandala, all other mental events, mental states, organize themselves around it. And some are closer to the Buddha, some are further away, some have no place in the mandala. So a way of looking at meditation is of reorganization of one's, of the mandala of one's own mind. Yes, yeah, so we have to find out what we have to work on. If you want to work on skillful, unskillful states, we have to find out what we need to do. A few years ago, Subhuti gave a series of lectures, of talks on the, what is it called? Know Your Mind, the mental events from the Abhidharma. And they're quite good talks, actually, very good lectures, can recommend them. But one thing he said, which I thought was quite interesting, is that his impression of most people in the order, probably most people in the movement, is that we are all very genuine in the way we want to practice. We really want to practice and work on ourselves. The problem for many of us is we don't know the details of what exactly we need to work on. So for most of us, probably our spiritual life, maybe our meditation is very general. We sort of want to develop. Yeah? But what is often missing is actually knowing exactly what we need to work on. And he says one of the ways of doing that is using the framework of the, I think it's 51 mental events, which are divided into skillful and unskillful and so on. I think we don't need to go to the detail of the 51 mental events, because we won't be able to remember them. There's a much easier to learn and more basic list, which is the five hindrances. I think everybody should be familiar with in theory and practice. The five hindrances are a way of looking at one's mind, looking at one's mental activities, and see sort of where's our main weakness. Yeah. So to say, I am distracted is not enough. Yeah, what kind of distraction was it? Yeah. That's a way forward. Yeah, to be precise about what kind of distraction, or a thought came up. It's a bit too general. Yeah. What kind of thought? So I find the five hindrances a very useful tool of assessing where I stand and what I need to do in the spiritual life in general and in meditation. So just to go through them. Craving, the first one. The first hindrance is craving. It's the sort of thing you crave. It's usually sense experience, sense pleasures. Meditation is boring because there's not much going on. You know, all you have is your own mind, and it's not very interesting. So we crave, we fantasize about all the nice things we want to do or have. Food, sex, holiday, whatever. So one way of distracting ourselves in meditation is by developing craving. The other one, sort of on the opposite pole in a way, is aversion and hatred. Yeah, so another way of distracting ourselves, it's sort of an unpleasant way of distraction, but at least it's more interesting than the boredom of experiencing oneself, is just sort of occupying oneself with people and things one doesn't like. Yeah. We talked about it yesterday. You can do quite good meditation, just sort of think about all their bad qualities, winning arguments in your mind with them, winning discussions. Yeah. So that's hatred or aversion. There are quite subtle versions of that around, actually, but I'm going to go into them later, or maybe not now. It can be obvious wanting to harm someone. It can be more subtle. I think there's something in the metta-bhavana that can come up. It looks like compassion. Like the four-stage person suffers, and he has deserved it. I think there's a bit of hatred in there. Sort of, it looks like compassion, but I'm not sure what it actually is. Yeah, I mean, I must admit, when I do the fourth stage of the metta-bhavana, I quite enjoy thinking about the suffering of my enemy. I mean, it looks like I develop compassion and metta, but really there's a certain enjoyment in the suffering that somebody I don't like actually has a hard time. And he has deserved it, which is good as well. So hatred can come out in all sorts of different ways. The other one, which seems to be most popular with people nowadays, is anxiety and restlessness. If you just think about all the things which might go wrong in life. Yeah, so you may be on a retreat and you worry about your journey home because you don't know what the weather will be like, you don't know whether the trains will be late. So you can come up with all sorts of catastrophe scenario. Yeah, so it's anxiety, the anxiety which you, it's basically, I think what anxiety partly is, you try to solve problems you don't even have yet. I think that's what you do when you're anxious. Yeah? You imagine a problem, and that may never happen actually, this problem. It may never occur, but you're solving it already. I think that's one way in which we can sort of entertain ourselves in meditation. Another side to anxiety is restlessness, the inability to be still. That you can't sit still, not because the body is aching, but because you can't sit still, fidgeting around. So it's another hindrance, anxiety, restlessness, and worrying. They are more active. Yeah, there's almost too much energy in the mind if you don't know what to do with it. The next ones are a bit more sort of passive. The fourth one, sloth and torpor, are sort of falling asleep in meditation. There's sort of two versions of this. One is more objective, when you are just tired. Yeah. So 4:30 afternoon, sex, sort of sleepy hollow in the shrine room. But the other one is more, you are actually not really tired, but it's almost a way of not experiencing oneself. Yeah. So, I mean, all these hindrances are methods we use to not experience ourselves. The first, we are more active. Yeah, sort of, you do something. The fourth one is more sort of you doze. You get into a state of dozing around. So it's sort of, you know, you're tired in the meditation, but not before and after. Before meditation, you have lots of energy. After meditation, you're completely fresh, but in the meditation, you're strangely tired. That's the hindrance. It's also a method of not experiencing oneself. It's not objective. Yeah, just a way of not experiencing oneself. The fourth one, doubt. It's probably the most difficult to... Well, I'm not sure. Speaking for myself, it's the one I'm least familiar with in terms of noticing it. It's sort of doubt about, can I meditate at all? Is this the right method? Should I try something else? It often, I'm not sure if I can generalize here, but for me, it usually comes when all the other hindrances are dealt with. So I can be on an intensive meditation retreat. I've got no other problem, no craving, no aversion, no anxiety. I could meditate. I'm awake. I'm fully there. And then doubt comes. Yeah. It seems almost as if the last hindrance to work on, or the deepest. It seems the deepest one. So these are the five hindrances. And on the one hand, there are ways in which we distract ourselves in meditation. But there's another use of that list, which is we probably have one favorite. Yeah. If we look at the way we meditate, there's probably one of them which we prefer doing. Our sort of habitual hindrance. If we know which one that is, we have learned something very important about ourselves. I think it's a brilliant list to learn about oneself, just to identify one's favorite hindrance. It's very useful. Because then we know what to work on, what our main problem is in life. I would say, not even the spiritual, our main problem in life. And if it's a habitual hindrance, it's sort of, well, we can do things in meditation about it, and I'm going to talk about that, but if it's the habit, probably the main work has to happen outside meditation. So we can look at what we talk about, how we speak, what we read and watch, the people we associate with, all these things we do outside meditation. They are probably an expression of our favorite hindrance. It's quite likely that this is the case. Yeah? So in this way, meditation is almost like some sort of experimental place where we really notice what's going on in our mind, or what we do in with our mind, and that shows us what we probably do habitually outside meditation. It's just that we're not that aware of it. Or it's almost we can rationalize it outside meditation. So we learn something about ourselves, and we know what to do. We know what to work on in our spiritual lives. Actually, the first book by Kamala Shida on meditation is good on that. I recommend getting both of them, by the way. We have only one of them, because they're slightly different. And the first one is this sort of wonderful list at the appendix about the hindrance. It's really good. Sort of, it's a whole list of things to do with each hindrance. It's very useful. So when we're in meditation, if we notice there's one of those hindrances, we identified which one it is, and then we need to do something about it. Yeah, so the effort of eradicating arisen unstable states. I think the main point is to do something. Yeah, that's the most important thing, not just be passive, just do something, whatever. There are different methods. There's developing the opposite. Yeah, so if you suffer from hatred, look for elements of love and metta. If you suffer from craving, it's good to look for elements of contentment in your experience. So develop the opposite. If you suffer from sloth and torpor, wake up, open your eyes if you need to, and so on. So it's developing the opposite, considering the consequences, where does this lead to what I'm doing? There's a so-called blue sky method, which seems the most popular one, where you just sort of sit and let it sort of pass away. It's only one of the methods. It's not the one which is helpful for everything. I wouldn't recommend it for sloth and torpor. Probably the dark night sky method then. Yeah. If nothing helps, you can suppress it. Just act of will. I don't want to do this. That's perfectly legitimate. And if nothing else, it's a traditionalist. If nothing else, you sort of give up and go for refuge to the Buddha. I think it's Bhante's thought. It's not really a method, it's more an attitude. And these methods, I think that's useful to sort of know about them. And we have to sort of learn which one to use when. Yeah? Some are more appropriate than others. So if you suffer from anxiety, considering the consequences may not help. Probably make it worse. It is useful for hatred and craving. Yeah? It may not be the best one for anxiety because it just make it worse. Not only are you anxious now, but think what it will lead to. Yeah, so it's just good to have the whole range of methods. So another list. I was going to say I'm sorry of bringing up all these lists, but I'm actually not really sorry because I find them useful. So with the hindrances, we learn something about ourselves and we know the area we need to work on. So these were the ways of working on the unskillful mental states. Sort of in terms of organizing one's mandala, one pushes the unskillful bits to the edge, sort of over the edge of the mandala. But there's another way of looking at meditation, which is more developing the positive. And in a way, I wonder whether it's, we need to learn about the hindrances and know about them. But there's a danger that we see meditation too much as a problem solving. It's also about developing something positive and actually pleasant. So part of meditation, a big part of meditation, is developing skillful states and positive mental states. So the most obvious method is what we do in the Metta Bhavana, the Brahma Viharas, the Metta, compassion, mudita, and so on. There's also this sort of factors of meditation which you also develop. There's the so-called dhyana factors, which are the mental states which are strong in a very concentrated state. So there are basically, sometimes they're called two kinds of thinking. I'm thinking it's more two kinds of attention. Yeah? Initial sustained attention, which are more with the attention span. Attention. Then there's the two which I think are more important for most of us, is joy and bliss. Yeah, or rapture and bliss, and there's one-pointedness. Yeah. There are other ones, for example, Shraddha is also one, faith. Yeah, faith is present in all the skillful states. What I find interesting about them is meditation, if you get into it, is actually joyful. I think it's something to sort of forget that. Yeah. There's sort of two teachings. I think they're sort of two expressions of the same teaching. One very basic one is by Bhante. It's basically the concentrated mind is the happy mind, and the happy mind is the concentrated mind. I based almost the whole meditation on a solitary on that. Interesting, yeah? So when you concentrate in the right way, happiness will arise. There's a more detailed way of looking at that, and that's the teaching of the 12 positive nidanas, which you probably all heard about. And in a way, they are a meditation manual. You can actually see the 12 positive nidanas as a meditation manual of how to meditate. And I sometimes do it. I find it quite helpful. I'm of course going to talk about the earlier stages of the 12 nidanas, which have to do with meditation. So we have independence upon dukkha arises Shraddha. Independence upon Shraddha arises joy. It's Pramoja or Pramodya. Independence upon joy arises pity and the other dhyana factors, priti or rapture and the other dhyana factors. And as I said, I find a quite practical way of doing it. So one of the very practical ways we can start our meditations is by contacting and developing our Shraddha. I can't recommend trying it out. I think often we think of starting meditation from the bottom. Yeah, we are aware where we are, our body, our mind, what's happening now, and then we work our way up into meditation, which is one way of doing it. There can be another way of doing it. You start at the top. Yeah. So rather than giving lots of attention on yourself at the beginning of the practice, spend some time thinking about the Buddha. And what can happen, and let allow Shraddha to arise, and joy to arise, and that can almost pull you into meditation. I think it's one of the, I find a quite useful way, or quite a good way of starting meditation. Yeah? You don't start with where you are now, just a bit bleak and so forth, to work up. I mean, it's a way, don't alienate from yourself, but another way of starting meditation, start at the top. Yeah? Think about the Buddha, allow Shraddha to arise, you enjoy that, and from there you go into meditation. There's also something else about this list which I like. It connects our meditation to our most basic ideals, our highest ideals. It connects our meditation to what our life is about. Because the early stages are independence when dukkha arises, Shraddha. So we try to be in touch with why do we actually practice. And just in addition to that, awareness of dukkha alone doesn't lead to Shraddha. It's just not mentioned in the list, but you need awareness of the Buddha as well. Yeah. It's not just sort of dwelling on your misery, which leads to Shraddha. It's actually, you know why you practice, but you also think about the Buddha. That may be even more helpful than dwelling on your suffering. Yeah, so we can begin a meditation, in a sense, with sort of most what's most important in our lives, why we practice, what our life is about. Connect with that in terms of the Buddha. We can do that in terms of the Buddha or the Dharma. Allow joy to arise and take it from there. Yeah, give that joy more space, develop it, nurture it, and that can lead into meditation, into the meditative states of joy, bliss, and so on. This sounds easy, but it isn't, as you all know. And what I think is even doing that requires Shraddha. I sort of got a sense that Shraddha is almost one of the parts which make the proper meditation possible. Itself, I tried to experiment with that on the solitary 2 years ago. I was trying to work on the assumption that the concentrated mind is the happy mind. So I thought, well, if I just concentrate, I will become happy. Yeah. So I tried it out. It was quite interesting what happened. If I just relaxed and had faith in that, joy did arise. When I did not have faith in that, I became more active, slightly tense. I tried to make joy arise, to will it into existence, and that didn't work. I think that's basically what willfulness is about. So I didn't have the relaxed faith that joy will arise if I just concentrate in a relaxed way and apply myself. If I wasn't in contact with that faith, with that Shraddha in that fact, I had to produce joy, and that didn't work. Yeah. Or I tried to look for joy already in my experience. There wasn't any. That didn't work either. Yeah. And then I gave up and thought, well, it's going to be random. Either it happens or it doesn't. And that didn't work. Yeah. So I think it's quite a subtle way of working, I've found. It's a very subtle way of working meditation, that fully applying oneself to the practices, to concentrating your mind, while at the same time not trying to will the result into existence. But it's not easy. I mean, we sort of, as we push too hard, we will it into existence, and then we get a headache, and I can't meditate. And then it doesn't work, so then we give up, and think it either happens or it won't. And then it won't happen. So I find it quite a subtle way of working. But what I found, the faculty which helped me doing that was Shraddha, was the sense of Shraddha. In a sense, I think it's Shraddha in Pratitya Samuppada. This being that becomes. Yeah? Concentration being joy becomes. Yeah, so this is looking at meditation in terms of developing and maintaining the positive, the pleasant. And it's also quite an interesting list because it describes the path as something very joyful. Yeah, so it's one of those things which, if I mean, I certainly have seen often before when I study the 12 Vedanas, but it really is of notice at some point, actually, the path is supposed to be joyful. And you enjoy something for its own sake. I think finding joy in meditation, developing joy in meditation, is that you do it for its own sake, not for something else. Yeah. It's not some sort of hard, unpleasant training you have to go through to then reap the benefits later on. There's something enjoyable. I think if you want to meditate sufficiently and you get into it, we need to learn to enjoy meditation. A few more points. So it's more to do with the depth of meditation. I'm coming back to the idea of reverence and revering our training. And as I mentioned yesterday, part of an aspect of reverence is not to assume we understand what it is we're doing. Yeah. So yesterday I applied that to ethics. Yeah. Not assuming we have fully grasped the precepts, but keeping a sense of openness to we don't yet know where that leads. And that's the same for meditation, maybe even more so. That an element of our meditation, in terms of revering meditation, is we don't assume we understand the practices. In some ways, we understand them. I think that should not lead to sort of feeling like a complete failure if you can't do it. In some ways, they're quite straightforward, the practices. Yeah? Mindfulness is quite straightforward, just be aware of the breath. Metta is quite straightforward in a way. If you feel some friendliness to people, we can do the Metta Bhavana. Yeah. So we can trust our ability to do the practices. We can have faith in that. While at the same time, not assuming we really understand the depth of mindfulness or metta or any practice we do. Because otherwise we can get into this sort of thinking that we mastered a particular practice and then we can go to the next one. But I think that attitude is slightly dangerous even, because then you're thinking so you don't make any effort anymore. Yeah, so I think it's quite important for meditation to have a sense of there's depths to any practice we do, whether it's mindfulness or metta or any other, which no matter how long we have practiced, we haven't fathomed yet. So with mindfulness, there may be depths to mindfulness we're not aware of yet, where they can lead. I often get that when, I think it's always a good sign of a good retreat, when I get a sense of, I understand the practice a bit deeper, but I'm also aware that there's more opening up which I'm not aware of yet. I think that's usually a sign of a good retreat for me. Yeah? My understanding of any practice, whether it's mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana, the paramitas, it has deepened. I learned something new about it. And at the same time, I've got a sense of there's more to it, which I haven't got yet. I have that very often when we do the Anapanasati retreat here, which I've done most years. I don't know how many I've done. And with the Anapanasati, the 16-stage mindfulness of breathing, I don't feel confident in teaching it. I've done it so often, but I don't feel confident in teaching it to people. Because I'm quite aware of sort of, I don't quite know what it's about. I mean, I know how to do it. I can apply myself and sort of know it to some extent. But I got a strong sense there's mysteries in there which I haven't looked at yet. So with something as obvious and seemingly clear as mindfulness, we don't really know yet where that leads. What I always find when I do this, there's something very mysterious about the four satipatthanas I find. So quite sort of, I get some kind of taste of what they are about. And of course I can explain them rationally, but at the same time, some kind of taste of what they can be about, which I sort of don't get yet. Even stronger with metta, yeah, even more with metta. You can do the metta bhavana for, I don't know, many years. I don't think there's any further practice than the metta bhavana in terms of positive emotion. It's not that you do the metta bhavana, you've done it, and then you do like bodhicitta practice, which is higher. So instead of going deeper and deeper and deeper into metta, is bodhicitta practice. And I also want to stress that no matter how many years we've done the Metta Bhavana, there's still more to learn about it. Yeah, I think quite recently I've got to learn new things about the Metta Bhavana, which are very interesting. To do this, so as I said, we've got a sense of there's more to the practice than we think. To do this, we need to actively go deeper into the practices. That mean it requires more effort. And that means straightforward doing more of them and sitting longer, frankly. But with any sport, I mean, you get fit by doing more of it. That's how fitness works. You sort of start what you can do and then you sort of expand what you do, expand your practice. So with any other sport, meditation is sort of, we need to sort of push a bit beyond what we feel comfortable. Yeah, so part of getting deeper into the practice by doing more of them or doing them longer. Actually, something very practical, which I sometimes do, is we have these sort of 1.5 sits in the mornings. And the default position is we do one of the main practices and then just sitting. Or one of the main practices and then the other one. Or if you have a double sit, we do first mindfulness of breathing, then Metta Bhavana. I can recommend doing something different. Do a very long practice. Yeah? Do a double Metta Bhavana and see what happens. Or sort of double mindfulness of breathing. Or with a double sit, do Metta Bhavana, and the second 40 minutes are the last stage of the Metta Bhavana again. Just spend 40 minutes on the last stage of the Metta Bhavana. It's quite interesting to do, because that only enables us to go deeper into it. Yeah. Or we have these sort of 1.5 sets we're doing now. Yeah, you can do Metta Bhavana and just sitting. Or you can do Metta Bhavana and then the fifth stage again, but this time 20 minutes long. So these are sort of quite obvious ways in which we can just deepen our meditation. Just explore them. I just want to end on the Metta Bhavana as a practice. Oh yeah, maybe more on both practices. I said that, I'm quite sure how I'm going to approach this. If we have the Buddha at the center of our mental mandala, then the meditation should sort of refer to the Buddha, or to the Dharma, to the Sangha. So what we try to do is we make the practices we do into Buddhist practices. I think it's quite important with the so-called basic practices, mindfulness and metta, because we teach them to beginners and we learn them as beginners. And then obviously, you don't go to the full depth of the practice. And there's a danger that we get stuck on a fairly superficial level of doing them. Yeah. So when we do the mindfulness of breathing, a way of sort of approaching it, which is sort of not wrong, but a bit superficial, is seek as a practice of to relax, to calm the mind, and so on. Which is sort of not wrong. Yeah? But it's almost we stop ourselves by not going deeper into the sort of dharmic Buddhist principles of the mindfulness of breathing. Yeah? The deepening of mindfulness. I think it's funny, so yeah, we want to do the practice in a Buddhist way. So we sort of see them as practices taught by the Buddha, and it's something which can lead very far, rather than staying on the surface as sort of just relaxation techniques or calming the mind techniques, or even worse, making the mind empty, which I'm not sure is actually possible. It's sort of, I find it more obvious with the Metta Bhavana, because there's a sort of way of doing the Metta Bhavana, which is more about making you feel good. Yeah, sort of, so the way to do the Metta Bhavana is not thinking about people as they are, but about people as you like them to be. So you create a nice fantasy world and you put people into it. I heard that mentioned once by somebody. It's like sort of, he imagines a nice garden and puts all the people into that nice garden. Well, that may help to get your emotions going, but it's sort of not enough really, because it doesn't take into account the way people actually are. So when we do the metta-bhavana on a more existential level, more Buddhist level, we have to understand what metta actually is. So when we wish somebody happiness, we have to understand what happiness actually is. Yeah? And if you see it in a sort of more dharmic way, happiness is not so much about pleasant experiences, but about skillful states. Yeah? So if you wish other people happiness, we wish them skillful states. Yeah? The same applies to self-metta. Yeah, and if we want to develop self-metta, it's not so much about, I mean, of course we wish ourselves pleasant state, obvious, but on a deeper level, we wish that we are able to develop skillful states and able to practice. So there's sort of deeper ways, or ways of looking in a deeper way at the practices, and yeah, make our practices more Buddhist. Yeah, makes the metta bhavana into a Buddhist practice, almost the most sort of existential way of practicing. So when we do the metta bhavana, look at people as they are, not as we want them to be, yeah? And look at sort of that which makes us living beings. So it's quite straightforward. The first stage of the metta bhavana is quite straightforward. Just I notice I want to be happy. I don't want pain. But in a sense, that's all there is to the first stage. You're just noticing this. You don't have to have a high opinion of yourself. Because if you don't have one, would you make it worse when we think about ourselves? Yeah. So we don't have to be good people to do the first stage of the metta bhavana. Yeah, first stage of we notice we don't want to suffer. It's very deeply rooted. It's what we are. Yeah. Self-cherishing. We care about ourselves. And then we see this in others. Yeah. So the second, third, fourth stage of the metta bhavana, we look at the friend, the neutral person, and the enemy as living beings. Not as somebody who gives me pleasure, whom I don't care about, and who makes my life difficult. Yeah, this is the standard way of seeing the friend, neutral person, enemy. Yeah. So we try to sort of go underneath those sort of more superficial characteristics, yeah, and more sort of see people as they are at its deepest level, which is beings who don't want to suffer. And that turns the metta bhavana into a sort of practice which is more in line with reality. Because yeah. It sort of brings us more into contact with each other as we are, but as something changeable and not on the base of changeable characteristics. And then basically we see this with everybody. Yeah. So we just are aware of everybody as somebody who doesn't want to suffer. Yeah. So there are sort of ways of deepening the metta bhavana or deepening our understanding of metta. Moving from a more superficial idea of I try to find out what their taste in music is and I wish them to listen to the piece of music. Fair enough, but it's not enough. Going more deeper into a more existential being, which then turns the metta bhavana more into a, I call it Buddhist practice or more existential practice. It turns on a practice which is more in touch with how we are. Okay, so these were my points about meditation and the mandala. So we can see meditation as a sort of way of organizing or reorganizing our mental mandala, where we have the Buddha at the center. If we have the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha at the center, certain mental activities sort of should move away from the center or even be pushed over the edge of the mandala. That image was thrown out, which requires sort of activity, and sort of we need to know what we are doing. Yeah, so we need to, I'm afraid, learn all those lists and then work on it. Okay, thank you.